WATD presents Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
You're a good man, Charlie Brown. You're good at what you do, too.
She is Natalie Jacobson.
You are the dean of South Shore Broadcasters.
Putting the South Shore spin on politics, current events, and pop culture.
Best-selling author, Dave Wedge. You got to say that.
I'm sorry. Thank you, Mayor. Yes. Thank you. Wonderful to be here. Kevin's been a long time. Thanks for all you do. All you know, your local news icon. We appreciate it.
Kathy's doing a great job at this. And I've decided she's jelly. I got to be peanut butter.
There was a debate about that.
You fine with jelly?
I'm fine with jelly.
Okay, good. Jelly spikes my sugars.
Good evening and welcome to Monday Night Talk. As you know, I am not Kevin Tachi, and I'm going to be your host for the first hour.
Massachusetts State Auditor Diana DeZoglio. Welcome back to Monday Night Talk.
It's great to be back. Thanks so much for having me, Kevin.
Jermaine Wiggins, member of the 2001 Super Bowl champion New England Patriots. Welcome to Monday Night Talk.
Oh, thank you for having me. Anytime.
Not just economic development, but it's how to get the businesses involved.
Senator, I want to thank you.
Thank you, Kevin. I appreciate you being a voice, bringing so much community news to folks here on the South Shore.
And now, your host, Kevin Tachi.
Welcome and good evening. You are tuned into Monday Night Talk here on 95.9 WATD, and yes, the rumors are true. I am Kevin Tachi, and I will be your host up until 8 p.m. this evening. We have another amazing lineup for you to better inform you, keep you up to date on things that are going on, and some of the conversation is to enlighten you on some things, but we'll start things out. We have our State House report. We do that with regularity. But this particular State House report is going to be a little bit different as something we started between myself and State Representative Kathy Lenatra, who represents the 12th Plymouth District. Do not ask me to name off every community that's in that district, but we have like a little bit of a challenge, a personal challenge to for the betterment of ourselves, whether it's to be a little bit trimmer and leaner and, you know, for better mind, spirit, and body. She's going to be here, and we're going to talk a little bit about where we're at this point. I know there are listeners who have actually reached out to me and said, hey, we're kind of following along, and I'm doing X or I'm doing Y, and, you know, we're going to be following your progress. Okay. Some of you are going to be happy with the update. Some of you might be disappointed, but we're not here to... We're not here to glean any kind of a disappointment or accolades, but just to kind of share, we're human, just like you, regular people. So, and we'll also find out what's going on with the representatives, some of the things that's going on either up at the State House or within the district. So that's all coming up in a few moments as she's warming up in the bullpen, getting ready to jump on microphone and join me. Following Representative Lenatra, we're going to speak with best-selling author Casey Sherman. So he's going to be here to talk a little bit about his new book, Murder, A Murder in Hollywood. This thing now is, he's not just a New York Times best-selling author, but he's got a number one book in America, especially when it comes to true crime. So Casey's going to be coming in, talking a little bit about some of the latest updates with his book tour, and you know, again, having a number one book, according to USA Today. So we'll chat with him about that. And then hour number two, a special author, a guest, Amalia Lazou, and she's going to talk to us about her book, From Intention to Impact. It's going to be a very interesting book about, this is in the aftermath of George Floyd's murder, some of the things that have transpired. And she kind of gives us a little bit of her background as to being someone who was a consultant when it comes to diversity, equity, and inclusion, and how she's had to kind of modify and shift things. So that's all coming up in just a few minutes or within the next 2 hours. But we now turn our focus to our very first guest, State Representative Kathy Lenatra. Representative, how are you this evening?
I'm great, Kevin. Happy Monday.
Yes, thank God it's over. It's kind of a long day.
Long day for Mondays.
As far as your road to betterment, how are things going for you?
Things are going well. You know, January was a great month. I think we all start off fresh in January, and we're all more motivated in January.
Full of zest
and vigor. And, you know, the workouts, I've been very consistent. And I, as I shared with you, my goal was to become much stronger, which I definitely have. Very happy with that. Now we're just really looking on becoming a smaller size. So I've been consistent with the workouts. Eating, you know, I'm out quite a bit. That's always a difficult thing. It's hard to give up that pizza. That's my downfall is pizza, and I like all kinds of pizza, and there's so many wonderful pizza places out there. But still going at it, still going at it. This is my goal for this year, so I'm still going at it.
What is your favorite pizza? Do you have a favorite type of pizza?
I do, and it's a fig pizza.
Really?
Yeah, fig and prosciutto, and the cheese is either like a strong cheese. It's
not a mozzarella.
No. It's not a goat. It's like a crumble, some kind. So they're really good, and it has fig jam on it. 3V does an amazing one.
I love 3V.
I do too.
It's a fantastic.
Little shout out to 3V.
Definitely a shout out. Hey, and if you want to sponsor the show, 3V, you can contact them. Kidding. Yeah, same here. I have somebody who likes, I like pizza. I like all foods. Mm-hmm. I'm not one who says no, and that's my biggest problem. I did have a chance to speak with my dietitian.
I'm curious.
Well, it was some eye-opening insight from her. When I first walked into the office, they make you you take off your jacket, strip off your socks and shoes, your shoes and your socks, and then you got to get on this machine, and then it kind of measures your BMI.
Yes, I've had that done.
And then, you know, and of course, I've kind of, you know, most of my sand is kind of floated down to the bottom of my hourglass. So it's one of those things where they're measuring the bottom of the hourglass, and it's kind of uncomfortable because, you know, I realize that it's there and I don't, you know.
Yeah, I hear you. Yeah.
So, and then sitting down with the dietitian, it's just like, if you want longevity, mm-hmm. you are at the age, and I'm in my mid-50s, mid to late 50s.
We're the same. Well, I'm a little younger than you, but we're, you know,
yeah, close. I think you've taken a trip or two less around the sun than I have.
Yes, a little less. Not much less.
Not much less. But the idea is that I need to, my calorie intake, my daily calorie intake has to be less than 2,000. And so, and it was funny, my Mrs. Sandy, she's like, she goes, why? When she'll make me these, she'll make these fantastic little egg and cheese English muffin things on a Sunday morning. She goes, those are easily like half to two thirds of what you're allowed to intake for a day. And I'm like, wow. She's right.
She's right. Yeah.
And I've actually done those diets. I've done kind of the high protein, complex carb type of diets, which, you know, almost borders on Atkins.
Yes. Yeah. Or keto. High protein, low carbs, low sugar, no sugar.
So I've done, mm-hmm. And that's the other thing. No sugar. And I've got like this color-coded list of what I can have, what I can't have. I got a little, no sugars.
I have that color-coded list as well. I think everyone's handing that out. But it is. It's more high protein. When I tend to eat mostly protein, so 120 grams, I would try to get in a day. And to cut my carbs, that's when I see the scale move, when it's more protein, low carbs. And I'm not a sugar person, so that's not a thing for me. But that's when the scale moves for me. But as soon as you see that piece of pizza and you start eating that pizza, it goes right up. So it's you know, it's a balance, though. If you can find the balance, I think you're all set. But, you know, 2,000, my calories, like, I'm supposed to be at 1,200.
So I'm supposed to be at 15.
Yeah.
1,500.
It's low. It's low.
It's very low. Now, what I've done previously is whatever your weight is times 10.
Yeah.
That would be the amount of your calorie intake. So let's say I'm 250 pounds. Mm-hmm. Let's just say. Then times 10 means that I could do 2,500 calories or less for daily intake. And as you reduce, you modify that number. And so that's where I'm at now. So, I mean, I've lost the last time we were on, I think I shed a couple of pounds. Kind of, I've stayed neutral. I'm trying to get into a habit. It was funny as I actually had to do like a food diary.
Oh, yeah.
And do a couple of pages of those. She's like,
that's eye-opening, isn't it?
She goes, it seems as though you like ice cream. I go, I do. You know, I'm like a bear. It's like, you know, the winter months, I'm trying to
Well, the winter months, it's getting warmer this week, so I think that is a motivating factor as well. And just get out and move. Just walk around the block. Like, it's the moving.
Yeah. So I was going to try to attempt to do all this just on diet, but she says, no. At least 30 minutes worth of exercise, even if it's just going for a brisk walk.
Mm-hmm.
That's going to be the way to go. And so my next appointment with her, she will be checking, and she's already said that she wants to see some kind of significant, you know, improvement.
Right.
That she just want to see me, you know, be at weight X, and then when I come in, it's the same. She wants to see some kind of improvement. That means that I'm invested in what she's trying to help me with.
That's great. I think that's great that you made that step to see a nutritionist.
But see, you and I, though, have a similar problem.
Mm-hmm.
And that is that we are constantly busy.
It's a challenge.
It's a challenge.
Not a problem. It's a challenge.
I retract the word problem. You are correct. It is a challenge. It's a challenge.
It is a challenge. You are correct.
And knowing it again, sometimes if you don't have enough time, sometimes I'd like to sit down and be able to have something eat. Sometimes I'll multitask. I'll be in the middle of editing something and trying to grab a bite to eat, and then someone distracts me, pulls me away, and I got to put down whatever I'm doing.
Right.
But it's, again, being so busy that sometimes I don't eat. Like, I sometimes will not eat until like 1, 2 o'clock in the afternoon.
Oh, I'm the same. It can be all day, and I get home at 7 o'clock at night, and that's when I haven't eaten all day, and that's when the pizza comes out. So that is the problem. If I was consistent and just had a protein shake in the morning and a protein shake at lunchtime and then maybe a salad or a dinner. But no, I will starve myself all day. It'll be 7:30, 8 o'clock. Everybody's all settled in my house and there comes the pizza.
Well, I'm going to throw in another element. And that is that I also asked about fasting. And I got the finger wags. Like,
yeah.
No. You can't do that. No fasting. But that's how I found success a couple of years ago.
You had mentioned that,
and I
right?
dropped some 65 pounds. But
wow!
But the problem is that it turns into what I have experienced over the years of when it comes to shedding the pounds. It's kind of a yo-yo thing.
Correct.
Right.
Yep.
Where, you know, I lose, and then I gain, and I gain greater than I was previously, and I lose, and then I gain greater. So it's kind of like that. Up and down, up and down.
The roller coaster. So, you know, it's consistency and it's lifestyle change and not, I'm going to do this crazy diet like keto. I did keto and during the pandemic and was smaller than I had ever been in my life. And, you know, I was a trainer for many years. But as soon as you're off that. So it is consistency and just life change, which easy for me to say here on the radio than to, as I said, have a protein shake for breakfast and something for lunch and not eat a pizza every night. So
pizza's so good.
It is. It is. It is. But not, you know, once in a while. Once in a while.
In moderation.
As I'm saying this, I had a pizza last night because I didn't eat until about 8:30 last night.
Now, how about Mike? Does Mike, your husband, is he trim and he doesn't have a good regiment?
No. He'd kill me for saying this. No, I'm fortunate. I have really good genes. I mean, my mother was a ballerina and still has that physique and still has that posture. So I was brought up I was an athlete too. So I was brought up shoulders back. She would always say that's push your stomach in,
posture.
Shoulders back. Mike didn't have that type of upbringing. You know, his parents loved food. And he's Italian. He's, even though I'm more Italian by blood than he is, my husband is from Brooklyn. So when you're from Brooklyn and you're Italian, you think you're 100%, you're right off the boat type thing.
Yeah.
So he was brought up with an Italian diet. So he struggles, but he's doing well. You know, it's easy for me to preach, so I can preach to him.
Yeah.
And he doesn't see me at night eating that pizza. So, but he struggles, but he's doing a great job right now. He struggles.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Kudos to Mike.
Mm.
Support. You know, and again, my Sandy, it's, you know, it's that support
you
is important.
That.
And she will, when I need to kind of be, you know, brought down to earth, I'm like going, hey, I've lost 3 pounds. He goes, yeah, well, you probably gained 10 before losing that 3 pounds. So it's like playing the lottery. You know, you spent $50, you win 25, and you go, hey, I won 25. Yeah, well, you're kind of 25 down still.
Well, Sandy's so small. Like, she's so slim and, you know,
but
that's what's challenging, too,
yeah,
when you have a spouse that's...
Yeah, she knows how to control it. She does an awesome job. She looks fantastic. Hopefully I look that svelte.
You look great right now.
Again, all the sameness at the bottom of my hourglass. And again, if you're just tuning in, we are doing a little bit of our update. We promised earlier on this year that we'd kind of do kind of updates as far as our personal modification and, mm-hmm. and growth and subtraction. State Rep Kathy Lenatra is kind enough. It was kind of her idea.
It was my idea. Let's,
you know, it started in one way. We kind of modified it and now we're kind of seeing how it goes as we.
But we hold each other accountable. And I think that's important. And we're realistic. We're not. You know, I'm going to drop, well, when at 55, I'm not going to drop 10 pounds in a week like I did when I was 25.
No.
So, and you know, we know we want to be healthy for our grandchildren and our, and so on, and be able to, you like to travel, right? And we want to travel into our older years.
Yeah, and that's the thing is that after this evening, I will be jumping on a cruise.
Oh.
And, you know, and cruises are floating buffets. And so I'm going to have to try to figure out how to avoid some of the, you know, they have pizza until 4 o'clock in the morning.
That's a challenge. That's a cruise challenge. Is a challenge.
You know, you're out and you're enjoying entertainment until about 2 o'clock in the morning. And then you're like, hey, I think I want a slice of pizza. Yeah.
That late night.
Yeah. It's the gremlins. But we'll kind of delve in. We're going to kind of change lanes now. Get kind of a little bit of an update. How are things going as far as up at the State House, in the district? I know that, again, you are a member of the Ways and Means, that I believe that it's a joint.
Joint Ways and Means. Correct, in the House Ways and Means.
How's that going these days?
It's so, as most everyone knows, the governor has dropped her budget, and we are going to take up the budget in the House the week after April vacation. So I believe it's the third week in April. So in the meantime, being a member of the Joint Ways and Means Committee, we travel across the Commonwealth and we meet with health agencies, housing agencies. Last week, I was able to go to Bristol Aggie High School, which was really, so we get to go to some places that I never would have had the chance to visit. So that was really, what a great school that is. It really is a great school. So that's what I'm in the process of now. There's 7 hearings before that April budget week. Learning a lot, as we all know, there's a deficit, you know, revenue deficit. So I am, as long as I've been a state rep, this is my third term, I've never been through that. We've always been flush with cash. So this is a learning curve for me. And it's very interesting. Each day brings new things. It's great.
Have you had any of your communities, any of the communities in your district who have asked you to come into their respective Board of Selectmen meetings or select board meetings to talk about where things, you know, happen financially and what they can expect for their respective town meetings setting their fiscal 25 budgets?
I think that would be something to, I haven't yet, but that's something to do after we see the budget, after the House comes up with the budget. Right now, I don't have that information to give them. But once the budget is set, I do have my community. So I, in the past, have been able to put in earmarks for the district in certain communities. So I've had, like, the fire chiefs have reached out for things that they need. Kingston has their 350th coming up. I believe it's the 350th. Don't quote me on that, but I believe it is. celebration in 2025, and they're looking for funds for that. My little town of Plimpton, which I adore, is looking for money. They have a comfort dog, so they need a vehicle outfitted for their comfort dog. So they're coming to me with little earmarks, where before I knew 90% that I was able to get them if they weren't astronomical. I really don't know what to expect. I do have on Wednesday have my meeting with the chair of Ways and Means, and I'll find out more then of really where we stand or where I stand as a rep representing the district, what I'm able to bring back.
Now, last year, were you on the Ways and Means?
I was.
How is this year different from last year? Is it more so, you know, knowing that there might be a little bit of a shortfall when it comes to the budget? Was that the biggest difference, or is there other things?
Well, last year, actually, most of it was virtual, so I didn't have the chance. Last budget season, it was this season, so I was able to, but the year previous, everything was virtual, so I didn't have the chance to visit these wonderful communities. It is definitely, yeah, we're told it's going to be a wake-up call. So we will see. We will see. But we're learning. You know, I'm learning every day. But my communities have been very fortunate with what I've been able to bring back, and I've been pleased to be able to do that. So hopefully there will be something there.
probably something I haven't asked you in a bit, knowing that this is the second half of a legislative session for you as a representative. Do you have any legislation that's nearing the finish line or that has a chance of being signed into law or even bundled in with other bills and being pushed?
It's been Joint Rule 10, everything needed to be voted either out of committee. This was last week or the week before.
Correct.
Voted out of committee, gone to study, extended, or redrafted. So out of all the bills that I filed, I believe there were 28, 11 were voted out favorably. Mm. There were 3 that were redrafted that will be voted out favorably. 2 were extended. So that's great news. And in some of them, I have talked to you in nauseam, Kevin, right? In nauseam, the voter safety bill, which I'm passionate about.
Important.
It's very important. Yep. So that was redrafted and voted out favorably. And then the officer wellness bill. That I put together with Captain Creed. So, and Frank Fredrickson, who is the former police chief in Yarmouth, has been very supportive with me. He sat in front of the committee and testified with me. And, you know, there was some really emotional testimony from our first responders and our police officers for that bill. So I'm looking forward to seeing where that goes. We're still advocating for that. Several bills about the blue economy that were voted out favorably. So it's been a good legislative session for me and for the Commonwealth, if these go through, because these, you know, will help the Commonwealth and support safety in most of them, and some of them in the district, too. So I'm cautiously optimistic, as always, but still advocating. And if you, any of our listeners,
any of you guys,
if things are important to you and there's still bills and you want to know where they stand, please contact my office and we can let you know where they stand. And if you still want to advocate, we can let you know how, and we can be your voice for that.
Again, we're speaking with the State Representative Kathy Lenatra, representing the 12th Plymouth District, and she's one of many state reps who visit on a regular basis just to kind of bring us up to speed. And again, it could be stuff that's happening at the State House, or it could be kind of personal things like we talked about for the first 12 minutes of our conversation here. Probably last quick closing note.
Sure.
I know that a week ago from this past weekend, the Plymouth County Democratic League held their little get together, and you and I had eye contact, but that was about it. But it looked like it was a very well attended event.
It was well attended. So this was the first John Walsh, very famous in the Democratic community, just an amazing man, had passed away this year. And this was in honor of him. So there were over 350 people there. We had Senator Warren was there. Congressman Lynch was there. Senator Markey was there. Mm-hmm. Kim Driscoll was there. I mean, all the Democratic heavy hitters were there and spoke. And it was there were so many people there that I wanted to connect with, you being one. Yeah. But once it started, there were so many speakers, you couldn't move. So I had to, there was a lot of texting afterwards, like, oh, I saw you from across the room. Sorry, I couldn't get a chance to chat.
Yeah, but you and I.
It is. But it was a wonderful thing for his family. His family is starting a fellowship program. You know, just an honor for him. He was a wonderful man. He did wonderful things. And it was a true honor, that breakfast. And it was put together by George O'Toole, who is the chair of the Plymouth County Democratic League. Mm. And he did a fabulous job.
A gentleman who's an officer with the PCDL, Roger Woods, actually, he invited me. He's like, hey, we're going to have a table. I will tell you, and folks hearing this going, oh, he attended a demo. I'm going to say this again, because I actually had someone walk up to me who wanted me to, that was going to asking me to sign something. Goes, oh, wait, you're Republican. I go, well, hold on. I'm not a Republican. I am not a Democrat. I am unenrolled. I like it that way. I attend Republican events. I attend Democratic events. I do it as a way because I have friends on both sides, and it gives me an opportunity,
right,
this radio show, to be able to talk to folks evenly and have a good conversation. I'm not someone who's already on one side of the fence or the other, and it's been accepted widely by folks who know me and who I am.
It's respected, Kevin. It's not just accepted. It's respected that you do that.
Yeah. So, well, anything you want to say quickly in closing as we wrap up our segment?
Well, let's, you know, it's Monday night. Let's hope we had a good day. Yep. I don't know how you did in your day today.
No
but
pizza tonight. No,
we're not going to go home. We're not going to eat pizza. Let's just have the best we can have. You know, do the best we can. Let's try to help someone every day, smile every day, make someone smile every day. And we'll reconvene and see how you do on your new nutritional program and how I do.
Yes, in a couple of weeks. We'll check in. We're back together once again. We're going to step aside, and when we come back, best-selling author Casey Sherman will be joining us. We'll talk about his latest project, his new book that is out on the bookshelves at this moment. You are tuned in to Monday Night Talk here at 95.9 WATV.
This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi, on 95.9 WATD.
Eat, drink, and socialize at the patio at McWiggins in Whitman Center. Sit down with a specialty cocktail and start your meal off with a patio sampler with chicken wings, egg rolls, potato skins, fried cauliflower, and chicken and biscuits. Watch the game on 7 55-inch monitors while digging into braised short ribs, fish tacos, fig and goat cheese flatbread, or Koji steak tips. Relax and listen to the live entertainment at the patio every Friday and Saturday night. And don't forget, McWiggins Pub next door. They're located at 546 and 552 Washington Street in downtown Whitman.
Invest your time in listening to Cape Retirement Radio and learn a smarter approach to investing so you can protect your future. Cape Retirement Radio, featuring Chris Letond, Thursday nights at 6:15 and Sunday mornings at 10 on 95.9 WATD. Welcome back to Monday Night Talk. Don't just listen, say something. Call 781-837-4900. We now return to Kevin Tachi and Monday Night Talk.
And we return for more conversation here on Monday Night Talk, heard on 95.9 WATD. And joining us, a regular guest.
Yeah, that's right.
Who stops by to kind of tell us about some of his latest projects. And sometimes he has his co-writer in tow, Dave Wedge. We're talking about none other than best-selling author Casey Sherman, whose latest release, A Murder in Hollywood, is a national, America's number one bestseller, right?
That's right, yeah.
How's that feel?
It's amazing, you know, and I will say, you know, I'm on national book tour, so I do a lot of television and radio interviews, but this is always my favorite, Kevin, because it's coming back home, it's talking to a friend of mine, and, you know, you've certainly, you know, followed the process and been a big supporter of not only myself, but as you mentioned, my previous frequent collaborator, Dave Wedge. So thanks for having me again.
As we get started, I think one of the first things I want to kind of mention is I know your brother's birthday was Todd's birthday was recently, and this book is dedicated to his memory. Talk to me about that.
Yeah, you know, my brother passed a year ago. It's been a real tough year for myself and my family. And, you know, my brother was always my muse. He gave me the idea to write The Finest Hours. He gave me the idea to write Helltown. And when I was researching A Murder in Hollywood, when I'm in L.A. and, you know, going over the primary source documents regarding this story, he would be the first phone call I'd make saying, hey, you know, I just found this out. Isn't this very cool? And he was my biggest champion, my biggest supporter. So I felt like I had to dedicate the book to his memory.
How does it feel to have another book be so well received nationally?
Yeah, it's exciting. You know, this book has really resonated with audiences around the country. It debuted on the USA Today bestseller list, which is kind of startling. Normally, it takes a couple of weeks to generate book sales great enough to even get that distinction. So the fact that, you know, USA Today Murder in Hollywood is the number one true crime thriller in America right now is surreal.
For those who are just learning about the book, A Murder in Hollywood, this again is the untold story of Tinseltown's most shocking crime. Give us the premise of the story.
Premise of the story is it really was the biggest scandal in Hollywood history, I would say all the way up to the O.J. Simpson case. 1958, Hollywood's, you know, biggest star, you know, Lana Turner. She was basically the Taylor Swift of the 1940s. That's how big she was.
Pin-up girl, yep.
Pin-up girl, actor, actress, producer.
Young age.
Yeah, she was in her late 20s, early 30s. And when the 1950s comes around, she's starting to age out. So she's not getting those plum roles she used to get. She had to actually pass her baton down to Marilyn Monroe. And in 1958, she gets involved with a man that, eventually reveals himself as one of the deadliest and violent, most violent gangsters in L.A., and he ends up dead on the bedroom floor of her Beverly Hills mansion, and we kind of go from there in the story.
So I've been reading the book. Actually, I've been going back and forth between reading the book and listening to the book, and it's really, to me, it's eye-opening as to the criminal element that's within it. Some of the predators
that are
involved in Hollywood that you really kind of describe in the book. We get to learn about a young lady who is known as Julia Jean, Juju Jean, Judy Turner, and would later be known by her stage name as Lana Turner. It was interesting to kind of learn about her story and her parents. What was it like researching her story?
Well, it's interesting. I go all the way back to her childhood. Her father was the victim of an unsolved murder.
Right.
He had gone out one day to earn enough money to buy her a bicycle, and he gets involved in a card game, and he doesn't make it out alive. So at that moment, she doesn't have any strong male influence in her life. And the next thing you know, her mother and herself are, hitching a ride to L.A., to Hollywood. And they literally get dropped off at Hollywood Boulevard with a rusty old piece of luggage. And it really kind of changes, obviously, Judy Jean Turner's life. Her discovery story in Hollywood is the most fabled discovery story ever, because it was Lana Turner who was discovered sitting on a stool at an ice cream shop by a Hollywood talent scout. And that changed not only her career, but also the trajectory of hundreds, if not thousands, of young women who all cobbled together their train fare and their bus money to go to L.A. hoping to be discovered just like Lana.
But she had this natural beauty about her that immediately struck a lot of these individuals.
That's right. And she was 15 years old at the time. So, Lana, quite frankly, lost her innocence at 15. Her first talent agent said, don't ever say you're 15 years old in this town.
One of the Marx brothers, right?
Yeah. Zeppo Marx,
right,
who became a big Hollywood agent. But, to your point, a lot of these guys were predators. And that was really the shocking reveal to me writing this book. I write a lot about organized crime, but I know those guys. I know that world. The Hollywood studio system was something that was a little foreign to me. So when I was researching it, I was really taken aback by how these young actors, not only Lana Turner, but Judy Garland, Dorothy from Wizard of Oz, they were absolutely abused by these filmmakers. I mean, they were put on drugs, amphetamines when they were 13, 14 years old so that they could work 70-hour work weeks. They were put on diets of cigarettes and chicken broth so that they wouldn't gain weight. So, it's a shock that any of these Hollywood actors actually survived that ordeal.
Let's talk a little bit about Johnny Stompanato, a.k.a. John Steele. Talk to me about researching her relationship, because my understanding early on is that it was rife with violent arguments and abuse, which I think eventually led to his demise.
Led to his demise. Now, what people don't realize and what I reveal in this book for the first time is that this wasn't an organic relationship. Mm. They didn't meet at a coffee shop or a book club. Lana Turner had a target on her back, and that target was placed on her back by Mickey Cohen. Mickey Cohen was the Al Capone of Los Angeles. You're going to read a lot about Mickey Cohen's ascension to power in L.A. in the book. And, he survives gangland shootings, bombings of his home in Hollywood. It's amazing that, that entire town was a shooting gallery in the 1940s. And when Mickey Cohen, goes to jail, comes out of jail, he doesn't want that violent life anymore, but he's still a criminal. So what he decides to do is target Hollywood's biggest stars for exploitation and blackmail. And that's what he does with Lana Turner. And he uses his young, handsome, underling, thug enforcer, Johnny Stompanato, to get inside Lana's world.
It's interesting. I was going to bring up Mickey Cohen because you bring him in early on from him, being a young boxer to his crossing paths with Al Capone. You actually used a phrase in the book as to Chicago being the finishing school.
That's right.
For criminals.
Yeah.
Which is fantastic.
Yeah. Well, you know, Mickey Cohen, you know, really was mentored by, you know, I would say the Lee Iacocca of organized crime in Al Capone. So, you know, you see the ascension of Lana and Mickey and how their lives eventually converge in an explosion of violence that Mickey Cohen doesn't see coming.
Again, we're speaking with the great Casey Sherman, best-selling author, Murder in Hollywood, out in bookstores. And also, you can also listen to it through Audible. Let's kind of talk a little bit about that. What was it? I mean, writing a book is one thing, but then having to, you know, verbally put it into publication. What was it like to produce an audiobook?
Yeah, you know, this is my second go around. I did the audiobook for Helltown, my previous book as well. It's an arduous task, you know, 15 to 20 hours in the recording booth. I couldn't stand the sound of my own voice afterwards, so I haven't listened to the audiobook yet, but people, you know, kind of are gravitating toward it, which is great, but it is difficult because you're not just, you know, pop stars go in and record a two-minute song. I've got to go in and record 75,000 words over a short period of time.
Well, it's interesting, and I think it was a point in regards to Virgil and Judy at one point where there was a record player, and you actually broke out into song for half a second.
Did I? Jeez, I don't even remember doing that.
Did, but, yeah, yeah. I'm like, oh, listen to him. Yeah.
Well, it's funny, you know, the audio engineer, when I recorded Helltown, I really brought my I would say, lack of acting chops to the recording studio, and the audio engineer just, you know, he'd pipe in and he goes, hey, Brando, you don't need to act out these roles, just read it, you know, and it just taught me, you know, don't be an idiot, Casey Sherman, just read, you know, read the words on the page.
I think you and I have had the conversation before where I'm a fan of both being able to read the book and be able to listen to it. And I think I had the first time I was able to do that was Natalie Jacobson.
Oh, yeah.
When she did her memoirs.
Well, and nobody could record Natalie's memoirs but Natalie. You know,
right.
You have to
but
hear
she was so
her.
Good. But hearing yours, again, I really had a greater appreciation hearing it from the author and how they're kind of depicting it. It just has that extra zest that I really appreciate. And I hope that people who are listening, you have a chance, buy the book, but also get the audio version as well.
Yeah, I appreciate that. You know, and that goes back to, I've had several audiobooks based on my my books, and, you know, some of the narrators always get the pronunciations wrong.
Worcester.
Yep. Yeah, so I want to make sure that if there's any mistakes on it, it's on the author, you know, not on the narrator. So I really want to take ownership of that side of the business.
Now, just I want to give homage to your book tour. You got a national book tour going on. What are you coming up for folks who might want to come out, buy a book, meet you in person, maybe get a book signed?
Yeah, that's great. So, you know, the book was launched in Los Angeles a couple of weeks ago. That kicked it onto the bestseller list. Mm-hmm. I've gone to Houston, New York City. Now I'm back here in Massachusetts doing a bunch of book signings before I go south. But locally, Saturday, March 9th is Barnes & Noble in Wareham. Mm-hmm. So I will be there 12 to 2 o'clock. For those of you who go up to New Hampshire or listen from that area, I'll be at Gibson's Bookstore in Concord, New Hampshire on the 14th, and then Brookline Booksmith on March 15th. That's one of my favorite bookstores, and I'll be in conversation with Emily Sweeney, who's a Boston Globe reporter and an author in her own right.
She's great, yeah.
She's great and a good friend of mine. So, but there's also kind of a fun event on Cape Cod, March 28th at the Chatham Orpheum Theater. Tickets are going to go on sale soon. I'm going to be signing books and introducing one of Lana's greatest films, The Postman Always Rings Twice. So we're going to watch the film, we're going to talk about the book and the film, and we're encouraging guests to dress up as their favorite Hollywood actor from the old days.
That's fantastic. It's a great concept as well. I know, again, you frequently flying out to Hollywood. Got anything else that is in the works that you might want to tease for our future conversation?
Yeah, Dave Wedge and I were out in Hollywood a couple of weeks ago doing a ton of meetings where we're getting some traction on a passion project of ours, which is the Ice Bucket Challenge. That's the Pete Frates story. We wrote that book in 2017. We've been, unrelenting in terms of getting that book turned into a film, and we've had, you know, Casey Affleck at attached at one point. And it just, you know, the actual development process in Hollywood on any movie is usually 7 to 10 years. So we're just almost getting to the 10-year mark, and we think we're reaching the finish line on that project.
How exciting is it that, you know, again, it's, you're not just somebody who writes a book, promotes the book, moves on to the next book, but you're able to take this to different other mediums to be able to kind of tell the story, even if you add a visual effect to it or an audio effect to it.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I write very visually, so I think that my books adapt very well cinematically. Terrence Winter, who created Boardwalk Empire, he won a slew of Emmys, writing all the greatest Sopranos episodes. He's got the number one movie in the country right now, the Bob Marley biopic. He and I are partnered on A Murder in Hollywood, so we're adapting that into a feature film, and we're talking to female directors, female, strong lead stars to tackle this project. We're really excited about it.
Are you kind of watching a lot of the accolades and the awards that are going on? We just had the SAG Awards, and prior to that,
I watch just because, you know, Robert Downey Jr. is my guy. He's my producing partner for Helltown, which we're adapting into a limited series right now, and his production company optioned the rights to my book a few years ago, and we've been working in concert ever since to get that miniseries made. So anytime Robert goes up to the stage and accepts an award, I feel a great sense of pride because I know the guy and I know how hard he works and I know how brilliant he is as an actor and how brilliant he is behind the scenes.
Yeah, that is interesting. Again, you know, he's won a Golden Globe. He's won a SAG, and I think he's going to be for, you know, Best Male Supporting Actor. I think he's going to be for the Academy.
Yeah, I mean, he's the number one, candidate in the clubhouse, so to speak. But you never know on Oscar night. Oscar night's all about surprises. So I'm still going to be, rubbing my lucky rabbit's foot until he gets that gold statue in his hand. And, thanks his lovely wife, Susan, who is really shepherding our project on Helltown. So it's great to feel that connection. And hopefully one day we'll be taking that same stage on another the project that is directly, you know, that I'm directly involved in writing.
Anything we haven't touched upon or you want to make sure that you kind of share with the audience before
we
say goodbye?
You know, I mean, A Murder in Hollywood is not, you know, old news. It's very relevant today because I elevate Lana Turner to her rightful place as a feminist icon because for decades, she's been treated as a femme fatale and a villain. She's not. She had to take her life back, and on Good Friday, 1958, after months of abuse and threats by Johnny Stompanato, she does. And it really, you know, my story flips the official version of the case right on its head. But that's all backed up by 20 years of investigative journalism and my deep dive into this case.
Have you heard from anybody in the Los Angeles area who have, you know, read the book or got wind of what you've put together and either giving you accolades or
yeah, LA else? Has been incredibly responsive. I've done a lot of press out in LA, done a lot of big book events, and they are coming up to me. You know, they either knew Lana Turner or obviously have known of her, and I'm learning a little bit more about her at each stop. And they've praised the work, but I say, look, you know, I'm just, you know, reexamining this case, telling the story I think the right way. And I think every actor and actress owes a debt of gratitude to Lana Turner because Me Too doesn't happen in a vacuum, Kevin. You know, this is something that went all the way back to the 30s and 40s, but it was Lana who flipped the script and went after the bad guys and did what she had to do to protect her family.
If folks want to follow any of your projects or if they want to know as far as book signings or anything like that, what's the best way to find out more about you?
Sure. I'm on social media. So Instagram, Casey Sherman Writes, X/Twitter, Casey Sherman 123, and then just Casey Sherman on Facebook. And I always respond to inquiries. So you never know where your next book project's going to come. So I like to engage with my audience that way.
There he is, best-selling author Casey Sherman, our guest for this part of the show, and he'll be back with more updates as they become available or as he creates them. That's it for hour number one. We're going to step aside. When we come back, more Monday Night Talk here at 95.9 WAT.
This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi, on 95.9 WATD.
Saturday, November 3rd, 1955, Bobby Palmer gets his brand new basketball backboard nailed into place on the telephone pole directly in front of old Mrs. Borden's house. Now, way back in 55, all backboards were metal and located at the park. If you wanted your own, you made it yourself, out of wood. And Bobby's was a beauty. He was 10 years old and handy. The problem was old Mrs. Borden.
You get off my lawn, young man! I'm calling the Brady Police Department! Now you give me that big ball there!
Bobby was not about to give up that basketball. Instead, he gave it a mighty heave at the backboard. The ball hit the rim, shook loose the metal hoop that fell through the windshield of old Mrs. Borden's 49 Hudson.
I'm Peter of Tiny & Sons Glass, 1-888-64-TINYS. We come to your work, your home, replace your windshield, improve your view, and your disposition.
What basketball hoop?
Follow Monday Night Talk on Twitter. Start at 959WATD.com/Monday Night Talk. And don't forget to add hashtag Monday Night Talk to your tweets. And now, more Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
And we return for hour number two of Monday Night Talk here on 95.9 WATD. If you happen to miss any of our talk segments, you can go to our website, 959WATD.com, or we're on Spotify. Best way to be able to download, especially if you're out and about and on the go. Well, we happen to have joining us an award-winning tenured strategist in diversity and inclusion and lecturer in the Technological Innovation, Entrepreneurship, and Strategic Management Group at the MIT Sloan School of Management. She's also a former EVP and regional president of Berkshire Bank and the creator of several accelerators designed to support minority-owned businesses in the Boston area, as well as the consultancy called the Lazoo Group. Joining us right now to talk a little bit about her book, From Intention to Impact, A Practical Guide to Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion, we have Malia Lazoo. Malia, welcome to Monday Night Talk.
Thank you so much for having me.
Let's get to know you a little bit. From what I understand, you're somebody who is well-tenured. You're somebody who has been recognized for many different things, Boston Business Journal's Women Who Mean Business. This was in 2019. Named one of Essence Magazine's 50 Founders to Watch in 2017. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, I guess tenured is a good way of saying older, right? you stick around long enough and you'll get the accolades. No, but I'm originally from Honolulu, Hawaii, which I think does help me do this work in a way, you know, being from the last state in the union, the most diverse state. We have a little bit of a different narrative out there. And I came to Boston and quickly found myself becoming an activist. I was at Emerson College and I started a nonprofit called Mass Vote, which is still around, and found this path of change work as something that I really wanted to do. And from doing change work, I found myself in the corporate world helping corporations figure out how they can have actual impact, right? With then it was called diversity, right? That's all we were calling it back then. And through working with companies, primarily banks, I found myself to be an EVP and bank president. And with my hands on power, I really saw what it took, you know, to make change and to hold yourself accountable to community. And that now leads my work and me lecturing at MIT and working with my clients.
So I understand that MIT Press was the one that published this book. Is this something that you did in conjunction with the school?
Yes, you know, I was lecturing. I mean, they have, MIT Press is its own house, right? And they asked if, I was doing a lot of the DEI research, and they asked if I thought I had a book in me. And, you know, my friends will tell you that I always have a book in me. And I decided to, take the time to really think about what would I want, you know, what would be my ode, right, to the business world, to the world at large, especially around this issue, and decided to move ahead with this practical guide.
Did you find it easy? What was your process to be able to put a book together? I mean, is this something of like notes that you have culminated over the years and a lot of your life's experiences in this field?
Yeah, well, the second half of the book is a practical guide, and that does really reflect the trainings, you know, the years of work, the experience that I have with working with, you know, different corporations, large and small. The first half of the book is, you know, is more theory based, right? And allows me to explain why DEI matters, right? Why you should care about it. And so I like to say the last half of the book, I wrote over the last 20 years, right, with all the work that I've done. And I actually wrote that half first, because I knew the steps, right? I had worked with clients, helped them get to impact, saw where we fell short. And so that section was much easier. In a way, was much easier to write than the first. And, you know, then I did research, you know, figured out what theory I really wanted to anchor the book in, and then wrote that. You know, that was really, when I think about writing a book, the first half really felt more like that. The second half felt, you know, again, more like building a curriculum, right? Something that I do all the time. All in all, though, you know, it was an emotional journey to do this, write this book at this time. And, you know, at a time when so many corporations are figuring it out and some of them are figuring it out wrong, I didn't want to oversell any one corporate effort as getting it right. And, you know, I think emotionally that's where I wanted to pay attention to my intention.
Is it accurate to say that this is more towards any business, small business, you know, that might have 10 to 15 employees to some of the biggest corporations on the planet? Would you say that this is kind of a helpful guide for them to kind of, you know, take their intention to bring DEI into the workplace?
Yes, yes. You know, I think that this, whether you're a small business, I mean, if you have one person yourself, right, and in how you think about what you're setting for when you grow, right, it's an important book. I think it's also an important book for, you know, governments, bureaucracies, school committees, right? We're all trying to struggle. We're all struggling right now to figure out how we see each other's humanity and how we come together. And I think this book will really help people do that. So, you know, we have examples of large corporations, but we also have examples of, you know, one shop real estate developers who, you know, decided that that they were going to expand through DE&I. And so I think it's going to be, you know, there's a lot of great stories in there for all different sizes of businesses and all different positions. One of the angles I take here is this idea of a decentralized structure and, you know, really reinforce that anyone can be a leader in DE&I. The CEO, you know, the management can set goals and can set budget, which is important. But no matter where you are in the company, you can help people feel welcome.
Are we still struggling as a culture when it comes to DEI?
Oh, yes.
How do we move forward as a culture to be able to make sure that there is diversity, there is equity, and that everybody is included?
Yeah, you know, I think this is right. The first, we have to be willing. And I think this is where we first start to fall down, right? We get nervous. You know, I gave a talk once and this, you know, person came up to me and said, you know, this white person, and said, I agree with everything you say. I just worry about my sons and, you know, their future. Right. And it's that natural reaction, which I think for this person seemed very natural. Right. But that stops us, right? If we think this is pie, if we think that this is scarcity mentality, and if we have the scarcity mentality, it's really hard to get to equity, right? Because you feel like you're working so hard, you know, and I hear from a lot of straight white men, including some in my family, you know, being like, when are you going to write the book for us? Right. Like, and when you're privileged, I can understand why equity can feel that way, you know? And so I think that that's the first thing that's hard for us, is really admitting that we have a problem and changing the narrative around that. But then the second piece I think that's hard for us is we're so tied to our growth model and our growth mindset, right? You know, growth, right? 3% GDP year over year, right? All these ideas, and that we need to continue to make money on a train that's faulty, but we can't slow down the train because then that quarter is going to be a bad quarter. And right now, the tools we're using to make money uphold, right, a lot of these old school institutional assumptions about what people have to offer. And, you know, there are some things that it would be nice if corporations were willing to explain to their shareholders the long-term investments that they're taking, and the fact that if they can get diversity right, they'll become 34% more profitable. I mean, there's very little that I can offer a business that would get them those kind of numbers. And so, you know, we believe it, we have the will, and then we do it. And I think we could see something, you know. Now the question is, will we do it? And I don't know if we get everybody, you know, but I do think that the young people are ready. You know, they're fluid, they're diverse, they're interconnected, and that's what they're expecting in their world.
If you're just tuning in, we are having a fantastic conversation with Malia Lazou. She's the author of From Intention to Impact. Turning our focus to increasing diversity in the workplace, we talk about as a culture, what are some of the problems? What are the barriers that companies face, and what makes it hard to move forward from that initial intention to actually making an impact?
The barriers are vast, but also we know them. And I think, you know, that's something I tried to lay out in the book, was you want to plan for these things, right? So I say all the time, like, I, as a Black woman, have showed up in and judged women and Black people in unfavorable ways, right? We all have a narrative that will have us fall short sometimes. And so I think the first thing is to remember that when it comes to diversity, when it comes to this issue, your kids probably know more than you. And so, you know, it's really important to learn the issue and really knowing the issue, understanding whiteness, understanding race, understanding disability, right? Understanding these movements. I mean, I'm old enough to remember when ADA was going to ruin business, right? There was no way Main Streets were going to be able to stay open if they needed ramps. And now that seems like foolish, right? No one would ever really say that. You know, so these barriers of pushback, and I talk about in my book these seven stages, right? And out of the seven stages, three are the honeymoon stage, three are the pushback, and then you have the last stage of you either doing it or not. And those cultural barriers, even in a business, are big ones. But then you have things, you know, that you might be dealing with, like, you know, is seniority, right, something that's important to you, right? Yeah. Because if that's the case, then you're going to have trouble bringing new people in and having them move up, right? Do you have a company where you have to have, you know, you have to have succession planning, right, to be within compliance, right? So that might mean you're setting a tone for a company for a generation, depending on how you're doing that succession planning. So these are, you know, issues that will come up, right? You know, you're trying to do vendor diversity and most of your contracts don't expire for another 3 or 4 years, at least the big ones, right? So you might not be able to move any real parts of your budget until that happens. When those barriers come up, it's important to see if you can work through them or prepare for when your company is then ready to take that step of diversity. So, you know, I don't think that there's any barrier that you can't work around or through, but you do want to be honest about what those might be, so that you can take your employees and your managers along with you.
Do you want to go in depth when it comes to the seven stages from intention to impact?
You know, I would love to. I like to say that these stages are something that emerged in, you know, after years of working with companies and seeing where they fell off, right? Where they worked through, how they dealt with the pushback. And so, you know, as I said, the first three stages are the honeymoon phase, right? Sure. The first stage is, you know, you can do something about the problem, right? You can, a CEO signs a pledge, right? A goal, right? You make a commitment. And then the second stage is you start doing something about that, right? So we signed this pledge. We're going to do trainings. It's great. And then stage three is you take action on low-hanging fruit. Oh, we're doing a hire, right? This is a chance for us to bring new and different lived experiences into the company. Let's make sure we do that. And then someone asks, and this is stage four, you start to feel pushback. Someone asks, well, are there lady mechanics, right? Like they start asking these questions that at the time might seem legitimate, but really aren't, right? Well, I don't know if we're going to be able to find people. Are we going to hire people with less qualifications, right? These questions start getting asked and it starts to murky the water. Right. And so you start responding, right, to these questions. And, you know, stage five is really about realizing that these questions are maybe not even asked when you were trying to do other projects or do other goals, but are being asked now, right? For some reason, this is a problem that no one in business can fix, right, for the company. There's just a barrier we can't get through. Compliance will never allow it to happen, right? You start getting this pushback and you realize, wait, this is actually the culture pushing back. This isn't legitimate pushback. And that brings us to stage six, where you realize that pushback is bias and it's bias in your culture, right? It's fear in your culture. And then you have to decide, are you as a company going to do it anyway? You know, my grandma always used to say, Jesus only had 12 disciples. We don't need everybody. And in this, that's the case as well, right? And you as a company decide, are we going to slow this down? Or are we going to be like IBM and open, you know, and start the first integrated factory in the United States?
So of the seven steps that you kind of guided us through, what stage or what series of stages are usually the ones that companies get stuck hung up on?
Four or five.
Okay.
You know, and a lot of times they loop through stages one through four, right? Maybe they get into exploring the pushback to really see if it's legitimate or not. But most of the time, once the pushback starts, it becomes uncomfortable, right? These might be friends of yours at the company, right? These might be people at the water cooler being like, Kevin, how long are you going to do this for, right? Like, you're going to keep inviting the ladies in? What's going on, right? Like, and all of a sudden, you know, and you're like, oh, come on, guys. But that gets uncomfortable after a while, right? You don't bring it up as much, right? You know, I hear from employees of color all the time that they don't want to be seen as the angry black woman, so they don't say anything, right? And then something ends up getting put out that's tone deaf and that the company has to respond to. And so, you know, I think it's important to understand that this pushback is toxic and deadly for any kind of cultural change if you let it have power. You know, I think it's important to recognize the discomfort of people in power, right? It's important to recognize that able-bodied people might feel uncomfortable. Straight people might feel uncomfortable. White people might feel uncomfortable. Americans might feel uncomfortable versus immigrants in this country. But that's the people in power's burden to work through, right? And so we want to recognize people in power's discomfort, but we can't center it, right? We can't center male discomfort or white discomfort. We need to center the discomfort of those who are being systemically excluded. That's really hard for a company to do, because I think at the end of the day, even the CEO might not totally believe it, right? And it can get like quote unquote political, right? It can make you feel like you might lose friendships. And in corporations where cover your ass culture is so important, you would just rather, right? What's that saying? If you don't do anything, you don't do anything wrong. And so you won't push to innovate.
Again, if you're just tuning in, we're having a great conversation with Boston-based author, award-winning author, Malia Lazo, on her book, From Intention to Impact, A Practical Guide to Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion. March is Women's History Month. Do you consider women to be part of an underrepresented group in the workplace? If this is true, what can be done about it?
Absolutely, right? And again, I think it's important to remember that all of us have an intersectionality, right? So do, you know, white women have the same experience as Japanese women, as black women, as straight women, as trans women, right? No, we all have different experiences. But what we see is that, we make less money than our male counterparts, right? That we don't have access to the same type of investment capital, right? So we do see that there's a systemic and implicit exclusion of women. And I think companies, you will find companies making strides on this issue with women quicker sometimes than with race or with people with disabilities. And that's really important to recognize, right? To lean into that. But it's still important, you know, if you have 30% women, that's great. We're 50% of the species. Maybe let us come in at parity and see our value in that, right? If you're ignoring 50% of the species for leadership, I guarantee you that's not a smart business decision. And so business is really understanding what they're missing out on, right? What we see in Silicon Valley is women have 21% more patent rates, women-led teams, right? We see that there's something in women leadership that maybe comes at team and effectiveness in different ways. And so rather than being like, no, we're all the same, no, maybe value, right? This is what's so dangerous about colorblindness, right? Value our differences, right? And see that there's a real value add that women bring to the table. And then talk to your women. You know, if you don't have an employee resource group and ways for folks in the company to find one another and to figure out how they climb the ladders in your company, start that, you know, let the women lead in how they want to be included.
Let's talk about something that you actually outline in your book about the importance of building a diverse ecosystem. Company and organization is serious about moving forward when it comes to DEI, that they need to make sure that they choose their vendors to be a big part of that. Can you talk about how a company can go about doing that?
Yes. You know, one of the biggest problems that companies have is that they're not in diverse ecosystems.
Right.
Right. A stat that I talk about in my book is that 75% of white Americans polled in this survey claim to not have one non-white friend. Right. So American segregation is still pretty complete. And so if you're looking at where to start, right, where do you start? Do you ask your one black friend, right? Do you ask your one Asian friend? And so being in these ecosystems are really important. And I think the vendor relationship is a great way to do it because you already have a transaction that you can work on together. Right. There's already something there that makes sense. You need paper, they sell paper. You need coffee, they sell coffee. Right. You need marketing expertise, they have marketing expertise. And so it allows you to get into community in a way that's probably a lot more comfortable. Right. And then they want to help their ecosystem get more business as well. Right. So asking these companies to help with your diverse spend, who do they know? Who would they recommend? Will not only help you build your map and your relationship mapping that you need to do, but also will help get the word out in the street that you mean this. You know, any marginalized community survives through communication within itself, right? These are the dangerous places. I mean, you know, any woman would tell you that works in an office, you pass around, don't stand too close to him, don't work with him after hours, right? To keep each other safe. And that's what happens with your business too, right? If you're giving diverse, you know, women-owned businesses, vet-owned businesses, minority-owned businesses a chance, they will tell one another, you know, and they will say, hey, right? You should go talk to Kevin's company because, you know, he does, you know, he gives us a chance, right? Now, that being said, once you do that, you want to understand that small businesses, women-owned businesses, minority businesses need to be paid on time, right? They may not have the same type of access to credit. And, you know, I mean, I've dealt with vendor relationships where it took 6 months for us to get through the vendor process and get paid. That can be deadly for a company. And so I think, you know, again, companies need to take the responsibility of the power dynamic and make sure if they're inviting women-owned businesses in, that they know that women don't have the same access to capital as men do. So they should have a streamlined vendor process and pay on time.
Malia, we just have just a few more minutes left, and it kind of makes me sad because I think this conversation, we could probably talk for a lot longer. But there is one thing that I want to kind of ask you in regards to someone who influenced your career, one Harry Belafonte.
Yes. Oh, Harry, you know, we're having a memorial for him. And that'll be aired publicly as well. And maybe people will get a chance to check that out. You know, Harry showed me what integrity looks like when it's walking on two legs. And, you know, he took a lot of hits to stand up for, you know, for Black people, for Latinos, you know, throughout South America, throughout Africa, in our country, to, you know, really hold us accountable and to make sure that we're living to, you know, the founding fathers' promise of life and liberty, right, and the pursuit of happiness. And to watch him do that and to watch him give up material things in order to stay right with his conscience is a lesson I will forever be grateful for.
As we wrap things up, anything that I haven't asked you other than how folks can get a copy of your book, anything you want to make sure you share with our listeners before we depart?
No, you're the expert here, and you took us on a wonderful journey. So thank you so much for that. I really appreciate the time, you know, to be able to talk about my book. And, you know, you can get it at your local bookstore, support local bookstores, and you can get it online. You can go to thelazoogroup.com, and we have a link right on my website that'll take you right to it.
Well, Leah, it's been a fantastic conversation. I want to thank you so much for your time. And I would love to have you back on sometime down the road and craft a conversation that is a best way to kind of get folks more involved when it comes to DEI.
I look forward to it. So stay tuned, everybody.
She is Malia Lazoo. She is the author of the book From Intention to Impact. She has been our guest. We're going to step aside just for a few moments. I promise when we come back, one final segment here on Monday Night Talk. Only heard on 95.9 WATD.
This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi, on 95.9 WATD.
Located in downtown Whitman, McWiggins Pub is a fashionable, upscale Irish sports pub with a lively bar and dining room. With all the class of a Boston pub, McWiggins serves a great pub menu featuring favorites like beer-battered fried pickles, Reuben sandwiches, shepherd's pie, bangers and mash, and meatloaf. And of course, they have Guinness on tap. McWiggins is a great place to eat, drink, and socialize with family and friends. With 8 flat-screen TVs, you'll always find yourself in the center of the action of your favorite team. And don't forget the patio at McWiggins right next door. They're located at 546 and 552 Washington Street in downtown Whitman.
By the middle of the week, so much news has come your way, you need your own team to sort it out. Lucky for you, there's Jared Valenzuela and the JV team to talk about the things you've heard and catch you up on some things you might not know.
I'm Jared Valenzuela. Join me and my guests as we have fun with current events and try to put things into perspective each week. Sponsored by Corey Welch of Boom Realty. Catch the JV team every Wednesday night at 6:15 here on 95.9 WATD.
Download the Monday Night Talk podcast from iTunes for free. Just search for Monday Night Talk WATD. This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
We return for the final segment of Monday Night Talk. And just because it's final doesn't mean that it's going to be the best segment of the conversations we have had this evening. We've had some great guests. Joining us right now is Rasan Hall. Mr. Hall is president and CEO of the Urban League of Eastern Massachusetts, also founder and principal of Rasan Hall Consulting, and also generally overall a community leader, a Brockton resident. Mr. Hall, welcome back to Monday Night Talk.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So the idea of our conversation, and I've already kind of apprised the listeners, and that is that we're going to talk a little bit about what's going on with the Brockton Public School situation. I'm somebody who I went to Brockton High School many, many moons ago, and the city school system has evolved over the years, a lot of changes. But as of late, we're seeing a lot of different things between budget shortfalls, a lot of finger pointing, a lot of issues with elected officials who are, you know, can't all get on the same page as to what's going on for the betterment of the school system. And I know last Monday there was a standout, and you were very prominent in one of the individuals who was kind of helping to lead a positive movement to support the teachers and the students and the residents. Just to kind of get your general thought as to, you know, how long you've been following this situation and your involvement.
Yeah, I've been keeping an eye on it as a Brockton resident. I don't have children in the school, but some of my close friends and neighbors certainly do. And irrespective of that, as a resident of the city of Brockton, I'm concerned about what's happening with the children in this community, because that impacts the vitality and well-being of the community. And, I mean, there are so many inflection points in this long story of the decline that has happened at Brockton High School. We can look at the recalibration that Governor Baker did when determining who gets counted for free and reduced lunch and the amount of funding that ends up coming through the school. But I think more recently, which also led to a Kids Count campaign that happened here in Brockton. But I think more recently, the focus has been on the budget shortfall, an overspend for the past school fiscal year, and then a projected shortfall for the coming year because of a decline in the overall number of students that will be attending or who are attending Brockton Public Schools. And I think that lack of funding that has led to a substantial number of layoffs has resulted in teachers not enough staffing in the schools, and particularly at the high school, concerns about disruption, violence, allegations of drug use. And I think some of that behavior is compounded. We've got children who went through the COVID-19 pandemic and missed in-person learning and socialization. And so when you take all of that together, the lack of staffing, the trauma and disruption that happened from the pandemic, and the frustration of the young people, we have this boiling point where we're seeing increased levels of disruption in the high school, and some of the school committee members pulled a stunt to raise attention. And whether you agree with the stunt or not, people in Brockton and throughout the state are actually talking about what's going on here. I think it's unfortunate because it creates a very negative narrative on the city and our children and community.
And knowing that Brockton High School is one of the largest high schools on the East Coast, you would think that there would be more resources that would be put towards making sure that you have enough teachers, paraprofessionals, technical people, and even folks who, you know, offer security for individuals who are troubled.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, part of the state's funding structure takes into account the lack of funding that the municipality can raise itself, accounts for the number of children who are living in poverty and have special needs or English language learners. So it's the Chapter 70 funding that the school gets. And that certainly makes up for some of it. But there's a huge issue around how the money has been spent, and allegations of overstaffing or lucrative contracts for individuals connected to through personal relationships to the school that have cost the school so much money that have led to this overrun in spending. And so it's a significant concern, but I don't think calling for the National Guard is the solution. And more to the point, Brockton Police Chief Brent Perez spoke at a school committee meeting last week and detailed a proposed safety plan. And I got to tell you, Kevin, it sounded like she was describing upgrades to a prison facility as opposed to addressing some of the underlying needs of our young people and getting them the services and supports they need, as opposed to creating more ways to lock down the school and surveil the students.
The one question I have, and nobody's asked, now, again, as somebody who went to Brockton High School, at that time, they had a small, albeit visible, police force that would be on the campus. I would be curious as to what has happened to that. Is that something that they have deactivated, or because of lack of funding on the municipal side that they've had to kind of pull back some of those officers and utilize them for the Brockton Police Department? I would be curious, seeing that there's, they're talking about that there's a lack of security, when there was a time, albeit many years ago, that there was, you would see Brockton Police, you would see Brockton police officers there, but they would be there to support school police, and school police would have their own vehicles, and they would, take turns going around to the 28 different schools that are around the city of Brockton.
Right. I mean, the school resource officers, or SROs, are present in Brockton High School. And, before, and this was brought up at last week's school committee meeting, before they were limited to just being on the first floor. Chief Perez has made that or has overruled that and decided that the police can be throughout the building. But there are 3,600 kids in that school.
Right.
And the four different units within the school. So it's a lot to manage. And I push back against the notion of more police are going to keep the kids safe. The students need to be invested in. They need to have proper instruction. They need to have proper supports and counselors and people who are helping them navigate the experience of high school. And it's not just solely an issue with the school and the faculty. It's also an issue around what's happening in the community. There is an inherent need to address root causes of the issues facing the student population at Brockton High School. And that starts with bolstering extracurricular activities and career pathways that will impact every student in Brockton High's hallways.
Again, if you're just tuning in, we're very privileged to be talking with Rahsaan Hall. He's not only a Brockton resident and community leader, but he's also the president and CEO of the Urban League of Eastern Massachusetts. And we're talking about the situation with the Brockton Public School System and everything that is causing the current situation in regards to fiscally, as far as the education component and being able to have a good learning environment. I want to kind of digress back to what I earlier mentioned when I was introducing you about the standout. What was your involvement with the standout and being a part of that? What would you observe during the standout that either probably made you proud to be a Brockton resident, or at least proud to see people come together to kind of be a support system?
Last Monday's standout was a great example of the Brockton community coming together across race, class, political, ethnic, and social lines. It was a strong community response, and it speaks to the resilience and cohesion of the broader Brockton community that is clearly invested in the next generation of our children. The City of Champions, we're investing in the next generation of champions. And so my role in it was working with other people to coordinate and organize the event, get the word out, and encourage people to come. And the framing of it was we want to show the students, the faculty, and the staff that the community is paying attention and that we are concerned. And as the buses were rolling in at 6:30, you could see kids looking up with shock and amazement. You know, of course, kids are kids, so some of them are just looking like, yep, what are y'all doing out here? But there were a lot of young people who reflected back to us through their facial expression their appreciation for seeing adults out in from the community out to support them as they were coming back from school vacation. And so my hope is that coming out of that, some of the groups and organizations that myself and others are connected with can come together to talk about community-based responses to address the needs of our students, separate and apart from the efforts to hold people accountable around the fiscal mismanagement, separate and apart from the interventions that the school will take to address security issues. Again, my hope is that the community can come together across these various groups, organizations, identities, and figure out the ways that we can stand together and support our students, the faculty and staff at Brockton High School, as well as the other schools in our district.
Now, this standout took place on the day prior to the school committee meeting that was held the following day, chaired by Brockton Mayor Bob Sullivan. I believe you attended. What did you come to expect from this meeting as a resident?
Well, having been at some school committee meetings in the past, I was hoping that there would be a time for an opportunity for community members to express their concerns. I didn't think that there was going to be a whole lot that was discussed. I think, you know, prior to the school committee meeting, there was the public safety subcommittee meeting where they were talking through some of the steps that were being taken to address the concerns around safety in the high school. But during the special school committee meeting, Chief Perez came and spoke and gave her recommendations to address the safety concerns in the school. And then there were two other additional matters that were brought up. One was taken in executive session, and there was another one regarding former Superintendent Michael Thomas and his desire to be back on full-time on come off of leave.
From what everybody has gathered, and I think everybody has kind of seen the video of the school committee meeting, and it seemed like there was a lot of saber rattling and there was a lot of finger pointing. How is the city of Brockton going to be able to move forward, especially in this area, if its leaders cannot find a way to gain some common ground and for the betterment for the future of the city of Brockton, our children?
Yeah, I mean, these students are our sons and daughters, family and friends, neighbors, and whether or not we can agree on the immediate path forward, we can agree that we all want to see Brockton High School community thriving, and we want it to be safe, and we want it to be resourceful. And so despite the challenges we face, the community has high hopes for the school and the community. And again, my hopes, as well as the hopes of the other people and organizations that we've been working with, is that different community-based organizations can come together and coalesce around a common mission of making sure that our students, our children, get the things that they need. And so in furtherance of that, the Brockton branch of the NAACP, the Urban League of Eastern Massachusetts, and several other organizations and community leaders are been in conversation about holding a town hall, a community-led town hall, March 12th at 6:30 at Messiah Baptist Church to be a larger gathering on these issues about how we move forward as a community and support our kids.
That's a great idea, but do you feel that it should be a one-of, or do you think that this should be a reoccurring where, you know, that there are updates where you could still have the town hall and say, all right, you know, we met, you know, 2 or 3 weeks ago, and you know, we had a great conversation, but nothing has been, you know, there's an intent here. When is it going to be applied?
Yeah, they're always, and that's the organizing cycle, right? There's an issue that comes up, and people coalesce around this issue and find what inherent resources we have to address that issue, develop strategies, and implement a plan to address the issues and the concerns. And in doing that work, we bring more people along because of their concern and interest in that. And it needs to be a sustained issue. It can't be, if we really want to see change, a one-off. And I think that is the beauty of bringing a variety of organizations together, because education isn't every organization's issue or priority, but there are things that are collateral to education, like the Urban League of Eastern Massachusetts. We are primarily a workforce development champion, and we support community organization leaders, families, and our students, because if they have a quality education, that leads to better employment opportunities. So that is a piece of that conversation that we're going to be engaged in. There are other organizations that focus on discipline and youth discipline and the concerns around racial disparities in school discipline. Those folks need to be at the table too. So it's coalescing around the issue. It's providing research and education on the issue, so there's ongoing conversations, and there are a ladder of engagement. So there are different points in the organizing and advocacy for people to get involved in the work, and all of it might not be for an individual or for an organization, but there may be pieces of it, different inflection points where people get interested and involved. And so that is the hope, that coming from this moment, this flashpoint, that we can have sustained engagement and conversation about the needs of the young people in this city.
Again, if you are just tuning in, we're having a great conversation with Rahsaan Hall, a Brockton resident, community leader, and president and CEO of the Urban League of Eastern Massachusetts. Let's not forget, also a founder and principal at Rahsaan Hall Consulting. Interesting you brought up as far as discipline. I've heard different cries. When you look at social media, sometimes social media, you know, it's free entertainment. Sometimes it's a place where people want to throw mud and put their two cents in, maybe where it doesn't need to be. But I have seen people who have said that a lot of the problems they feel that with the situation with the students and the students that some folks feel that there's a very small percentage of the student population that are causing some of the issues, that the greater population, maybe 90 to 95, you know, they have nothing to do with it. If anything, it's affecting their ability to be able to learn, and it's a distraction. But it's been brought up that it should start at home, disciplining kids. And also something that I guess was put into law back several years ago, Massachusetts Law 222. What do you know about Massachusetts Law 222, where basically there's a lack of discipline when it comes to an individual who may be acting out, and you can't suspend them or be able to punish them in any way?
That's a misrepresentation of what Chapter 222 actually is, and I know about it because at the time that it came into existence, I was at the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights. We were one of the organizations that was doing the advocacy around enacting Chapter 222. The premise of it and why it came into existence is because data and research showed that Black students in particular, but children of color more generally, were disproportionately disciplined for similar offenses. And so it wasn't that the Black kids were more disruptive or behaving badly, but the research showed that white children were disciplined at a rate of 1 in 27 students. Latinx students were disciplined at a rate of 1 in 12 out of 12, and Black students were disciplined at a rate of 1 for every 8. That is unacceptable. And so what the law was intended to do was eliminate zero tolerance policies. It didn't say that you cannot discipline students, but that there had to be a progressive discipline process, so that you just can't say, oh, you didn't bring your pencil to school today, you're in violation, so you're got in school suspension. No, there have to be other interventions and a disciplinary process before you just remove someone from school, suspend someone, and that's what it's about. It was part in part about addressing the racial disparities, because there's a correlation between the more disciplinary measures ultimately leading to students more likely to be suspended, and suspended students are more likely to be expelled, and expelled students are more likely to be involved in the criminal legal system. And so when we talk about the school to prison pipeline, early discipline leads to that. And so I think the conversation needs to be, what are the appropriate interventions, the non-expulsionary or non-suspension alternatives that the schools can use and to deal with and address the disruption and behavior issues in the school. There are different schools that are using restorative justice practices where people are being held accountable for the harm and disruption that they have caused. They're being held accountable by their peers and community so that they have a greater investment instead of just being punished, because we get better outcomes for people when we invest in a restorative process and have people held accountable to their community as opposed to just punishing them. So I think the calls for the repeal of Chapter 22, a turn a blind eye to the deeply problematic history of why we have that law in the first place.
Is it a problem that there hasn't been enough training when it comes to interpreting Chapter 222 and how to apply it properly and make it effective?
Yeah, I don't know how much of it is a function of training as opposed to resources to take approaches to alternative approaches to discipline and building out proper policies. I think another part, and you mentioned this or alluded to it earlier, is, you know, discipline starts at home. And so I think there's a lot of work that has to be done in community, but let's make sure that there are supports and services in place for families who need help with dealing with their children. Some children have mental health issues that need to be addressed. Some children have behavioral issues that need to be addressed. Some children are acting out because of disruption in the home or because of poverty or living in an insecure or uncertain housing situation. Let's address the underlying and root causes and not just say, well, these are bad kids and throw them out of school. Let's come together as a community and leverage the resources, both human and financial, that are available to really make sure our kids are getting what they need, because these are going to be the adult residents of Brockton in the generations to come. And if we want to have and be the city of champions, we need to make that investment now.
Excellent point. I don't think anybody could have put it any better than you, Rahsaan. We just got a couple of moments left here, but I've thoroughly enjoyed our conversation. If we could close this out, you're looking ahead. You as a resident, community leader, somebody who's going to be, I'm sure, watching this. Again, you get the great event coming up at the Mount Moriah on March 12th. Am I correct with that?
It's Messiah Baptist.
Messiah Baptist.
March 12th, 6:30.
I apologize. I get that incorrect. Okay. Well, and let's make sure we say it again as we wrap up when we say goodbye. But what are you going to be watching for over the next several weeks as things start to culminate and we get more information and we see how the city of Brockton and its leaders try to at least begin the healing and repairing of the situation?
I think there are a couple of advocacy initiatives that are happening. There's the initiative around accountability, around the finances. There is an independent audit that's happening, so the results of that are going to be very informative, and the community has been organizing around that and trying to educate the residents to understand how the budget works. And when the audit comes out, it's going to help us know who to hold accountable. Mm-hmm. But there's also the work around the community resources, trying to get people to volunteer in the schools to be a mentor, but also hearing from the students themselves and what they feel they need, not to put it on their shoulders to make them responsible for coming up with a solution, but to take their voice and concerns into consideration. And so lastly, I'll just say it's important that we look at the developments at Brockton High School not as a tragedy, but instead an opportunity. And so we can all work together to improve the situation for our students, our families, the teachers, administrators, and the school and the broader community. And as the president and CEO of the Urban League of Massachusetts, but also as a resident, we're ready and willing to be a partner and a leader in this work. There's going to be challenges, but together we can solve them for the betterment of our young people and for the future of the City of Champions.
Well, I would like to invite, if we wanted to bring parties together, and if you want to be one of the community leaders to be a part of it, I would like to use this radio show as a vehicle. I can, you know, we can do an hour long segment to kind of talk about it and bring all the key stakeholders and players together to have the conversation on a Monday night as things evolve and move forward.
That sounds great.
Excellent. Anything you want to say in closing, my friend?
Go Boxers.
There he is. Rahsaan Hall, who has been our guest talking about the situation, something that we will be following for the next few weeks to see how things start to either go in the right direction or who knows. But you've been tuned into Monday Night Talk here on 95.9 WATD. And until next week at 6:15 p.m., have yourself a great evening.
South Shore's first choice for live team coverage of breaking news, emergency traffic, and severe weather. 95.9 WATD FM Marshfield and 95.9 WATD.com.